Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck Nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's it going? We've been chipping away here for many years, and we keep doing it. It's always good. It's always exciting. It's always interesting to me because, as I've told you before, I don't really know what's going to happen anytime I talk to anybody. And I don't know what they're going to be like. I can make assumptions. But I just don't ever know, so it's always a very engaged situation. Today is a great example. Today is a great example. I talked to Malcolm McDowell. Now, we all know Malcolm McDowell. We all definitely know him from one thing, from one fucking thing that has been seared into all of our memories, and that's A Clockwork Orange. And if you had cool parents or you somehow got to see it before they knew what was happening, Caligula. That I don't remember what year that came out, but I must have been in high school, if not younger. But the truth is, he's been working almost nonstop for like 60 years. 60 years. He's currently in the series Son of a Critch, which just finished its third season on the CW. And I got to be honest with you. This is Malcolm McDowell. Now, look. You have him in your head. I mean, maybe I'm projecting, but you have this guy in your head. What was his name in Clockwork Orange? Alex. And that movie, I don't know when you saw it, and if you haven't seen it and you're over 30, it's too late for it to be seared into your brain properly. I saw it in high school. I saw it a couple of times, and it was like, what the fuck am I watching? All of it. It was a futuristic, it was a satire, and it was, oddly, meant to be funny. And I knew that I was going to be talking to that guy. And this is setting aside, 60 years of work. And Caligula, another thing, that movie broke my brain when I was in high school because it was filthy. There's a blowjob in the middle of that Caligula that was originally released by Guccione that it was just like, what? What's happening? It was just full-on porn. And apparently, as you'll find out in talking to Malcolm, they had no idea. There was big actors in that. There was Peter O'Toole was in it. Helen Mirren was in it. It was crazy. John Gielgud. I mean, it was a big movie. It came out in 1979. So I was still in high school when we went to see that, unbeknownst to the folks. But my parents wouldn't have stopped anything anyways. But it was a brain bender. And apparently with that cast, that high-level cast, they had no idea about what Guccione, the director, was going to insert into that. And I had a pretty long conversation within this conversation with Malcolm about Caligula and about some of the other actors. I literally thought that I was going to be talking to the guy from Clockwork Orange. And he's now like an older guy. But I mean, some things, they just stick with you, man. He's 80 and he's done a lot of stuff and he's a great storyteller. And I got to be honest with you, it's a great one. It's one of the all-timers for me just because he was so ready to talk and he really had a nice time. Okay, so there's a lot going on that I think you need to know about. None the least of which, is that the saying? I went on my old hike today with my newly healed foot, and it went fine. I even ran down like a fucking idiot thinking I'd break something else, but I was concerned, man. I was concerned about my fear. That's what I was concerned about. I was like, if this broken foot is going to be the thing that makes me nervous about doing the things that I like to do compulsively to make myself feel better, that's going to be a problem for the rest of my life. But I got up there and we were heading down. We usually trot down, and I felt strong. I had those on-running hiking boots that go up over the ankle for more support. So I was like, fuck it. Let's go. I was a little tenuous, but not afraid. Just careful, and it worked out. I did think I was going to break something else, though. But that went well. Now I just got to decide what to do with the arthritis on my bottom toe, big toe knuckles, which you could see in the x-ray when he took the x-ray of my foot. He's like, you got a lot of arthritis around there. I'm like, I know, dude. I've been in pain for years. But that's a whole other thing. What can and can't you live with, man? He said we could scrape it off, but it seems like the recovery would be something back in the boot. Look, I'm not going to worry about it. I'll just wait until my toes become non-functional. Look, I'll be in Texas this Thursday, April 18th, in Austin at the Paramount Theater as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. I'll be in Montclair, New Jersey on Thursday, May 2nd at the Wellmont Center, Glenside, Pennsylvania near Philly on Friday, May 3rd at the Keswick Theater, Washington, D.C. on Saturday, May 4th at the Warner Theater, Munhall, Pennsylvania outside Pittsburgh on May 9th at the Carnegie Library Music Hall, Cleveland, Ohio on May 10th at the Playhouse Square, Detroit, Michigan on May 11th at the Royal Oak Music Theater. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all my dates and links to tickets. Now, things might be changing, and some of you may be disappointed because, you know, through a very kind of harrowing process in terms of me making decisions, I have been cast in a show for Apple TV with the very funny Owen Wilson. Now, the show, I don't know what I can and can't tell you about, but I think I can give you the log line, give or take. He is a kind of washed-up golfer, washed-up pro golfer. You know, he was a pro player like 20 years ago. And I play his good friend and former caddy, Mitz. And it is about a relationship between two dudes who have been through some shit, but it's also about this kid, a prodigy, that Owen's character Price sees on a driving range and wants to take under his wing. Now, there's a whole series that unfolds here. We're going to shoot 10 of them, but I became interested in it. Initially, I was like, here's the thing about me, and I'll be honest with you. When I get offered anything, when I have any opportunity, even if I decide to take to do it, even if it's an opportunity I'm giving myself, I don't want to do it. I just don't like, I don't, as it turns out, even given my life, I'm a bit of a homebody. I don't like to shake up my patterns, and I do have patterns. I'm here in LA. I do my work at home. I have no problem occupying time. I'm self-employed, which means I never really stop working, and I don't know how to stop working. And, you know, I have my cats, and I'm very vigilant, weirdly hyper-vigilant in my connective relationship with them. Kit is here, and, you know, I have a life. And it's a relatively small one, but I find that the patterns of life, you know, are comforting and grounding. So when I have an opportunity that's going to take me out of my life for too long, I'm like, oh God, then what am I going to do? What are my cats going to do? You know, now I got to get someone to stay at the house. And like, what if one of them gets sick? What about my parents are old. And what about, you know, like, where am I going to eat? What's the story what kind of place am I staying at? Like, I just can't. That's why I only go out on the road in a minimal way. I do 3 or 4 dates at a time. I make sure to come home in between to regroup. It's just the way I am. And then part of me now, because I'm kind of on the other side of the arc and I've done okay and I've saved my money, there's not an urgency. I'm not desperate. I don't need to do everything that comes down the pike. And there was a time where I did. And, you know, that part of my brain doesn't really go away. You think, well, when am I going to get another opportunity? So it was a strange struggle for me to figure out how to do this and continue to do the podcast at the quality and intensity that you guys have grown to expect, and what we do here that is unique needs to continue on. This is my primary vocation and creative outlet along with stand-up. So in order to take and do a TV show, you know, I've got to figure out, we've got to negotiate how I can do all the other things that I do, my other two jobs, effectively. Now, look, you know, I can take a little time off stand-up. I've never really have, but I imagine I'll be able to do it where I'm going to be shooting. But that's the deal. I'm going to shoot 10 episodes of a TV show with Owen Wilson. And now that I've decided to do it and they've accommodated my needs to continue at least doing my other jobs as efficiently as you are used to and I am used to, I saw no reason not to. Work doesn't come that often, and it's a difficult time in show business. And the truth is, this character is a heavy-hearted dude, and I relate to the character. I relate to the relationship. I like the idea of working with Owen and seeing if we can find a groove together. It is a golf show. I don't know a ton about golf. I'm not a golfer, but I've been studying, I've been watching, I've been learning about golfers and their lives. I don't think that I have to do any active caddying or golfing, but nonetheless, I am familiarizing myself with the world and beginning to put this guy together. So that's exciting news, but I wish I could say that, like, right from the get-go when I got offered, I was like, yes. No, I was like, what? No, I'm going to retire. And then it's sort of like, dude, you're 60. I want an opportunity like this. It is sort of a stretch to be in this world and to be working with a guy like Owen and to sort of build out a guy who has, I think, some of the similar things to me, but isn't me, and kind of like make some progress in some of the things that I want to do with acting that I haven't done up to this point. I'm a little more aware of certain things. So that's exciting, but I shouldn't say canceled, moved. So don't despair. The only problem with moving gigs is who the fuck knows what kind of world we're going to be in after November, but maybe I'll have to change the whole set. I don't know. I do not know. But I will let you know when and where those gigs are that we're rescheduling. And I apologize in advance, but I'm going to do a TV show. So look, okay, Malcolm McDowell, as I said before, I thought it was going to be intimidating, but Jesus, did we have a good time. And did he tell some great stories about some old actors that I know, maybe you'll know. I don't know. It was just one of those ones where I was, as I said before, I don't know what's going to happen in here. And my assumptions are almost 95% wrong. Founded in fear and a little bit of dread, and which is fine. That's the way I go into it. And to be pleasantly surprised and engaged and entertained and connected 95% of the time is good. Those are good numbers. Unfortunately, the preparation causes me a little stress, but I'm used to it, and I see it as my process. But Malcolm McDowell is currently in a show called Son of a Critch. Full seasons of the show are streaming on CWTV.com and on the CW app. And here we go. Me and Malcolm McDowell.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
You looking at that Mick Jagger poster?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we he doesn't talk to me anymore, but...
What'd you do?
We were quite good friends at one point.
It's pretty amazing to see them.
Yeah.
Still at it. I did a long bit on my one of the specials, a couple specials ago.
Yeah.
Just about how it's gotten to the point as a Stones fan where I'm a little uncomfortable.
Yeah. Look, I mean, better to have a little than none at all.
That, sure. Yeah.
You know? And you have to tip your hat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was with Mick, this is in the 70s.
Oh, so peak Mick.
Yeah, this but the later 70s.
So okay.
After
Disco
the,
Mick.
After the huge tours and all that. And we were hanging quite a bit because we had mutual friends. And it was always, you know, with the various crowd of people. And, I remember sitting with him in somebody's apartment in New York, and him. We were looking over the park.
Yeah.
It was dark.
Yeah.
We were sitting on like a window bench.
Yeah.
And we were just chatting away. And he says to me something like, "Of course, Mal, you know, I can't see myself doing this at 50. And I went, 50? Good God, no. I mean, 50, it would be sort of gross.
You know? Right.
He goes, yeah. So, you know, and then he looked over and he goes, "The king lives over there." And I looked over and I went, yeah, John.
Really?
Yeah.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
That
Mick,
the reverence. It's the interesting thing about the Beatles and the Stones, you know?
Yeah.
Because did you watch any of that documentary?
Oh, yeah, I watched it all.
It's crazy, right?
You know, I'm from Liverpool and saw them as the Silver
Beatles. You did?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've heard this thing, and I keep bringing it up, and I can't get validation on it, that the owner of that club...
Yeah, the Cavern.
The Cavern had some stash of some old Nazi amphetamine. And that, like, that the guys were hopped up.
That's bollocks.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
I really don't believe that. They may have been hopped up.
Right, but not on that.
And I'll tell you, I had no idea what I was watching. I went with a girlfriend. She dragged me in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a tiny room.
Yeah.
Basically a vault.
Yeah.
With a vaulted ceiling.
Yeah.
Small, though, not big.
Uh-huh.
And the place was, like, seething mass of rhythm.
Yeah.
And watching these guys are so together.
It's crazy.
So together. The great, you would think, my God. And this is a local Liverpool band. They weren't even the most popular on Merseyside.
Yeah.
The most popular band was the Merseysippies, a jazz band. They had a poll in the local paper. Right?
Yeah.
But there they were. And immediately your eye went to John.
Really?
To John.
Yeah.
Because he was, as they say in Liverpool, the hard knock.
Yeah.
And he had the edge.
Yeah.
And he was the, like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Fuck you. You don't like it? Fuck you. And you know, Paul was all.
Sure. All Paul.
Yeah, all yeah. Paul.
But you could tell right then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, would I say, hey, they're going to be the biggest band of all time? No, of course not. But you'd say, I said, wow, these guys are fucking great.
And this is before Ringo you saw him?
Before Ringo.
Wow. Yeah. I can't even imagine, because there's footage of that stuff around, and they were operating.
Very little. There's one kind of, I think, one clip that I've seen.
And they're going fast.
Yeah. Well, that was it. They didn't sing any of their own stuff.
Yeah.
Everything was Chuck Berry, Little Richard.
Sure.
And, you know, John has the greatest rock and roll voice.
Yeah.
I mean.
Oh, yeah.
And you know who John's favorite singer was?
Oh, I think I do. Was it maybe, was it Little Richard or?
Eric Burdon.
Eric Burdon. Oh, he could sing, dude.
Royalty, baby.
Yeah.
Royalty.
You know that guy?
Yes, very well.
How's he doing?
He's doing great.
Oh, good.
He lives in Athens. Married to a beautiful Greek wife.
Okay.
And in fact, I did a detour. I was in London 2 months ago, and I went, you know what? I'm going to see him.
Yeah.
I jumped on a plane and went to see him.
How was
and
that?
And he's great. He's great. It was lovely, you know, just to hang for a couple of days.
Those first few Animals records were just belters.
Yo, incredible.
Yeah.
You know that Eric was the Eggman, right?
No.
So they went over to John's flat. He's going, I'm fucking hungry. What have you got? He goes, yeah, help yourself in the fridge. He opens the fridge, it's absolutely bare except for a carton of eggs.
Yeah.
And he goes, there's only eggs here. And he picks them, starts to throw them. And he goes, hey, the Eggman.
That's where that comes from?
Yeah.
He loved Eric Burdon.
Oh, he loved him.
Yeah.
He loved him.
So but I have no sense of, you know, other than, you know, what you read about the Beatles, what Liverpool must have been like at the time. You grew up there.
Yes. Liverpool was an industrial working class town.
Dark. Yeah. Was it depressive? Or?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. It was depressive and, you know, miserable weather right there on the Irish Sea. You know, it's right on the Mersey, the River Mersey, which is...
It's a hard town.
A very hard town, and yet brilliant comedians and musicians coming out and artists. Because it's the kind of place that nobody went through.
Right.
You had to go.
Yeah.
That was the end of your journey.
Yeah.
And
I think it's sort of like diamonds. You know, you get these young people who are getting pressed by the oppressive environment.
Well, you know, they had the big influence. It's a big port.
Yeah.
And so this is where they got, you know, the Chuck Berry records
right.
and the Muddy Waters and all those wonderful blues singers from the Delta and all that from, you know, they came over on the liners.
And they passed them around or they came over with the military sometimes.
Exactly. Well, mainly on the liners.
Yeah.
That's what I think Paul said.
Yeah.
It may have been Paul's cousin or John's, I'm not sure which, that worked as a steward.
Okay.
And brought back a Muddy Waters record. And they all, of course, flipped.
And then someone gave it to Keith Richards and then, you know.
They got one in London and met on the Southern Railway. Yeah, that's... He goes, ooh, what are you carrying there? Yeah. I've got that record. That's a fucking great record. Yeah, no, that's amazing.
But you didn't hang out with Keith, right? He was on his...
No, I don't know Keith. I just admire from a distance.
Yeah.
I've always loved him, though.
Well, you know what's interesting about him is as he gets older, he just keeps talking. Like, for years, you're like, does that guy even talk much? And now, like, he's witty, funny,
he's
smart
fantastic.
Guy.
I loved his book, you know.
Yeah, great.
And, of course, it's his voice.
Yeah.
He may not have written it down.
It's pretty cool. He must have told the stories.
Oh, no, totally, totally.
And that was one of those mind-blowing things where you're like, this guy's not just some junkie. I mean,
no
he's
way.
Like the core
hey,
of it.
Look what he wrote.
I know.
That's all you got to say.
Yeah.
I mean, he's seriously one of the great composers.
Oh, yeah. He's the best. I love the guy. He just did a cover of I'm Waiting for the Man, the Lou Reed song.
Oh,
that
God,
I saw on YouTube. It's great.
I worked with Lou Reed.
You did? On
a movie called Get Crazy. A really weird, funky little movie.
Yeah.
And Lou Reed was in it.
How was he? Cranky?
Well, I know. Yeah, totally. But I didn't get to work with him. All he was, it was really about a New Year's Eve, big like the Fillmore East or something. And the big New Year's Eve party.
Yeah.
And he was on his way in a cab, but gets waylaid and singing in the cab and doing a doobie. And, you know.
That sounds like a more fun Lou Reed than I usually hear about.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
I talked to Laurie Anderson. His wife, and after he passed, and he's a big Tai Chi guy. You know, there's the things you learn.
Wow.
Yeah, he was writing a whole book about his practice, and she put it out.
Really?
And it's like one of those things. It's like Keith's book. It's like, really?
Yeah.
He had this other, but we don't know everything about celebrities or artists.
No, of course not.
Not of that generation. Now everybody, you know, everything about everybody.
Yeah, this you know social media.
Yeah,
just so you've all got to do it. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah,
know?
I'm tired.
Telling people what you did for the weekend. Who gives a fuck?
You don't do
you
that.
Know, I had a shit. Big deal. Get over it.
I'm assuming you're not on there. You're not on the.
Well, no, I am because I've been told. You know, hey, you've got to get your keep your you know your TV queue up.
Wow.
And I'm going, well, what? I mean, seriously, my Instagram is basically an obituary to all my friends who have passed away, and I'm left standing, you know.
It's not getting you a lot of followers?
I've got 70,000. It's
that's
not
good.
Many. It's not
that's,
bad
that's
many.
Not, that's not bad. So what is it? So your family, what's your dad do in Liverpool?
My dad was ran a pub and a hotel.
Wow.
And so it was great.
Hospitality business.
Yes.
Yeah.
Basically drank the profits. That was the only problem. But so growing up there was a sort of amazing thing. But you see, I went to a boarding school in the south of England.
Yeah, you got out.
I got out.
They had the wherewithal to get you out.
Yes. So they knew that I was getting into trouble there.
Oh, yeah?
So
better move me out.
You're heading the wrong direction?
I was heading in the wrong direction. So when I came back for the holidays, I had to get rid of my Liverpool accent at school because they mocked me and bullied me.
It was that distinct? They knew?
Oh, yeah. Jesus, yeah. And I had to affect, you know, a more neutral kind of accent.
Would that be a class thing?
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
And if you didn't conform, you were treated and mocked terribly.
Yeah.
I would sort of talk like that because I'm from Yorkshire, you know, it's a bit softer than Liverpool. It's a bit like Hindle Wakes, you know. Liverpool's hard. Hey, fuck you. Get lost, lad. Hey, come on.
Yeah. So what'd you turn it into, what you have now?
Oh, what I have now is a mixture of everything.
Yeah. You know? But when you went to boarding school, you had to be vigilant?
Well, it took me a year or two to figure that, because I fought it, you know. My instinct was to fight it.
Yeah.
And suddenly I realized, you know, that fighting this is really not getting me anywhere.
Yeah.
It's just getting me into a whole lot of trouble.
Yeah.
And these other guys are getting away with it.
Yeah.
I'll join them.
Right.
So
you focused?
I suddenly started to not say so much. And when I did, lose the accent.
So this was your first acting job?
Yes. Basically, it was.
Yeah.
And then the headmaster put me in all the plays. So that's really where I learned to act, was at school.
In boarding school?
In boarding school, yes. We did Shakespeare plays. I did all the great parts in Shakespeare before I left school at 18.
Now, did you like it?
Well, I must have done.
Yeah.
I think when I first walked onto a stage,
you
know, I remember feeling like I was going to throw up in the wings.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Getting the cue, walking on, and suddenly feeling, wow, I'm at home here.
You did right away.
I feel very comfortable.
Very seen.
Yeah, I can. And very powerful. You can make people laugh.
Yeah.
Just by doing little things.
Yeah.
You know, it's.
You just loved it.
I just loved
it. Did you understand the Shakespeare generally?
Well, I didn't totally understand the language.
Yeah.
And I still don't.
Yeah.
And I've been a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company in the 60s, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So from boarding school, you decide to pursue it?
I did what my father wanted me to do. I went into commerce.
Yeah.
He had a friend who ran a factory that manufactured roasted coffee.
Yeah.
And sold coffee. And I went in as a management trainee. They suddenly had one of their sales reps was arrested for dealing in stolen goods.
Uh-huh.
And they went, you better get up there. So your territory is Yorkshire. Now, that's like saying to an American, your territory is Texas.
Right.
It's big.
Yeah.
And this is, so I go up there selling coffee where they only drink tea.
Yeah. They really did. It's locked in the tea, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it was really like a training to be an actor, because you would have to affect whatever, whoever the catering manager or manageress you met.
Yeah.
You went with whatever they were, you know, going, you would affect whatever was going on.
And this wasn't instant coffee. It was brewed coffee?
Both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was both. And, you know, I had to go in. Sometimes they'd go, oh, thank God, the coffee man's here. Yeah. Hey, I've got a, I just sell coffee. I don't know anything about the, oh, I'll try.
Yeah.
And of course,
the machine?
I'd take the bloody thing apart and haven't got a clue how to put it back together.
Gotta go.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So,
yeah.
How do you get to the acting? Do you have siblings?
I do. My sister went off to be a Dior model in Paris.
Yeah.
And I have a younger sister. Yeah, she's living in England still. She's my last one.
Yeah.
And so what happened was, I had a girlfriend who went to an elocution teacher, whose name was Mrs. Harold Ackley.
Yeah.
It was on a brass plate.
Yeah.
And in Liverpool. And she said she was going to her to lose her to do elocution.
Right.
So she went, Malcolm, I think you better go. You'd like her. She's great. She used to be a silent movie star. Are you kidding me? Oh, okay, I'll go check
silent
her out.
Movie star teaching elocution.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And she was I'm in a trip.
Yeah.
I adored her.
Yeah.
And she'd go, Malcolm, she was blind as a bat.
Yeah.
And I would just read the stuff. And she goes, you know it so well. I go, yeah, I spent a lot of time working on this one. I mean, I was just, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, she got me into Lambda to do an audition. And I passed it, the audition. And one of the adjudicators there was a producer of a local repertory theater and offered me a job. And I instantly took it. That was it.
Doing what?
Playing parts and assistant stage manager.
Lambda is the London Academy. What does it stand for?
The London Academy of Music.
Yeah, that's one of the two. It's either that or the Royal Shakespeare, right?
No, RADA is right. The Royal.
Okay, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
That's where Albert Finney went,
sure.
And Peter O'Toole. The posh ones, yeah, went there. Lambda's rather more mundane, working class one.
And who were your peers?
You know, I didn't actually attend. I just did an audition there, and one of the judges there offered me a job right away in the theater, which I took, you know, instantly. I went off.
So you didn't train?
I don't. No. No, I did not train at all. Thank God. I didn't train. No.
So, but that was really a class difference between the two schools.
Yeah. Well, yes. There's many drama schools. There's another one called the Central.
Yeah.
But RADA is considered the best.
Right.
And RADA was it was probably the best. You know. And I mean, look, they could produce Albert Finney, for God's sake.
Yeah.
For me, was my generation's greatest hero.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting in the Odeon in Lime Street, Liverpool, and watching Albert in a movie and thinking, he's from Salford. It's 25 miles away.
Yeah.
I think I could do this.
Yeah.
I'm going to try. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, to get from Liverpool to London was a big deal.
Yeah.
It's like going to the Big Smoke.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
that's what we called it.
Yeah.
You're under the Big Smoke.
Yeah.
And it was very sort of intimidating.
Big city.
Oh, real big. I mean, Liverpool is like 750,000.
Right.
Or 500,000 or something. So pretty big. But
yeah.
But London, 8 yeah. million.
Yeah.
In those days.
Yeah.
And, you know, a very exciting place.
Well, what did your dad think of that decision?
He thought it was a big mistake.
Yeah.
He thought it was a big mistake. But the truth is, his father was an actor as well.
A working actor?
Yes.
Okay.
And actually a very successful one.
Yeah.
He was called an actor manager. So he put together a company and paid the actors, and they went on tours around, provincial tours around.
With Shakespeare or plays?
Pot boilers.
Okay.
You know.
So it was like an
Sweeney Todd.
Okay. So
no Shakespeare. God, no. You can't make money on Shakespeare.
It was a traveling troupe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. But they never talked about him, so I didn't realize that he was an actor.
Was he a monster?
No, he wasn't. His name was Beckett.
Mm.
And I remember him as a child, a young child, when I was about 4 years old.
Yeah.
This man with white hair lived in the top of the hotel.
Yeah.
This is in Yorkshire.
Oh, yeah.
And his thing was that he had to have a Guinness a day.
Yeah.
That was his thing. And when he passed away, my mother told me when I was a teenager, she said, oh, yes, Beckett, he left you his... You know, he left you his violin. I went, well, you didn't tell me. Where is it? I'd love his violin. She went, oh, we threw it away.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no sentiment with those Yorkshiremen.
Yeah.
Oh, we threw it away. Oh, really? Okay.
But you were too young to remember the war?
Yes.
Oh.
I mean, I was born in 43. I was apparently, I lived in Bridlington, on the east coast of Yorkshire, because my father flew in bombers, and we moved out there because he was based right there, right on the east coast, the shortest way over to Germany.
Yeah.
And all I do, I don't remember it, but I was told that I was blown off a table by a bomb that hit the nursing home at the end of the street. And, you know, what happened was the Germans would come over, they'd bomb, like, Leeds, the industrial city. So if they had any ammunitions left, they'd just drop it on the way back.
Okay.
And that's why they dropped it on this, it was, I mean, certainly wasn't an industrial town. It was a seaside town.
Yeah. Isn't it crazy that, like, because my dad was in the Air Force, but he wasn't a flyer. You know, he was a doctor, and he was stateside. But just to know that at some point your dad had to learn how to fly a plane?
Well, he didn't fly. He was a navigator.
But even that, just to be in a plane, it's crazy. Did he talk about it?
No.
It's wild.
They never talk about the war. All he told me was, you know, they had these tin hats they used to wear.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, with all the flak coming up, I used to sit on mine.
Right.
I went, Dad, it's a tin hat. That's not. He goes, it was psychological. So psychological.
That's the one war story about how your dad protected his balls.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's important.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So when does the first break come? What are you doing? With film?
The break came. I did a lead in a television show, a one-off, play. It was watched by a very important casting director in London called Miriam Brickman.
Yeah.
She brought me in to meet this director called Lindsay Anderson.
Okay.
And at the time, I was working at the Royal Court.
Yeah.
And we were doing a modern dress version of Twelfth Night.
Okay.
So I arrived for the audition. I meet this man who is extraordinary looking guy, very short, got a Roman nose, piercing eyes.
Yeah.
And he goes, so, Malcolm, well, what are you doing? I told him.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm doing a, you know,
Twelfth
modern,
Night.
Modern dress, Twelfth Night at the Royal Court. I was so proud to be, you know, have gotten to the Royal Court, one of the most avant-garde theaters.
Yeah.
You know. And he said, oh, it sounds awful. I went, really? Anyway, we spent like half an hour gossiping about how bloody awful the Royal Court was and how pretentious they all were.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of going with it and enjoying it. You know? And not forgetting I'm there, you know, trying to get a part. And they, well, there's a bit of a lull in the conversation. And he looked at me and he said, you do realize, of course, that I am a director of the Royal Court. And I went, oh, what? No. I suppose I'm not going to get this part then, am I? He went, not necessarily.
Yeah.
Anyway, he brought me back again and I got it.
So, yeah.
And
that was If?
If.
Yeah.
And
big movie.
It's one of the great movies of that period. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's on, you know, the lists.
It's on the list, yeah.
And that was you.
Yeah.
It's all you.
Well, it's an ensemble piece.
Yeah.
But you know, he's the main rebel.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was extraordinary working with him.
And this is like, it's really like at this time, like it's on the, it's like, the arc of that British New Wave thing, it kind of happened, right?
Yes.
So it's the tail end of it.
The tail end. It's not Kitchen Sink.
Yeah.
This was, you know, Lindsay Anderson was absolutely, you know, one of the great directors.
Yeah.
And he only made 5 movies. It's not because he was a movie maker so much as that he did the most brilliant stage work.
Yeah.
And it was all at the Royal Court.
Yeah. Which was really pushing the envelope.
An
art theater.
Yes,
totally. Taking chances.
It was always taking chances. They did Look Back in Anger, which changed Western writing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was completely changed everything. And, you know, they did very avant-garde stuff. And,
yeah.
Edward Bond stuff. And Pinter started there.
Pinter.
All those guys.
Yeah.
Joe Orton.
Oh,
my God.
Yeah.
Joe Orton was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Loved him. I did the first revival of Entertaining Mr. Sloan at the Royal Court with this wonderful actress called Beryl Reed.
Mm.
And Beryl Reed was a vaudevillian. She'd grown up in vaudeville.
Yeah.
But she's also a brilliant actress.
Yeah.
And we came to do this. Now, she couldn't remember a bloody name, you know. She was getting on a bit, and she loved the brandy.
Yeah.
And I remember the very first preview that we did.
Yeah.
She has to go on before me. I'm standing at the back in like a silhouette light. She goes on, switches the light on in these stiletto heels and goes, "Mr. Sloan, this is my room." And she got the biggest laugh. Yeah. But just her walking in stiletto heels,
right.
The whole place, it was like a huge eruption of laughter that completely threw me. I was checking my flies. I was thinking, is my dick hanging out? What's going on? I had no idea. And, you know, in rehearsals, she was fighting, trying to learn it and all the rest of it. And when it came to the audience in, she was on.
Yeah.
And she was absolutely brilliant.
And some of those, like the people that came up in vaudeville, in burlesque.
Peter Sellers.
Yeah, is that somehow or another, because of who they are naturally talented-wise, but if they're comedians, every moment's going to be funny. Their physicality.
Exactly.
Like that there was a need, I think, on those stages.
Well, you know, you see the person, and immediately you smile.
Yeah.
Immediately, you're ready for it.
Yeah.
And so, whatever. I mean, and the way she moved in these stilettos was, I mean, it looked like she was taking a poop or something. You know, but it was absolutely.
So, that was it. That was the physical comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
So, now, is it my speculation that because of the nature of England and of the UK in general, that when you do a movie, it's going to be seen?
Oh, yeah. So, they don't make many movies there.
Yeah, and it was insulated in a way.
It was insulated. It was also a really important movie because it stuck a dagger into the heart of the sort of, the ruling class.
Status quo, yes.
So that it was about public school, which is their private school, which is where the knobs send their kids to be educated, to go out and administer the empire. That's basically why the public school came into being, and we're going back 600 years on some of them.
Right.
And so to have a revolution at the end and to have these rebels come out on top was sacrilegious. It caused enormous... I mean, you would not believe it. It was just they were fighting for survival, like they're kind of doing now.
Yeah,
you know? It's like the end of a breed,
right?
You know, it's sort of
so that brought it in, and that was 68. So that was where everything was
68. Sorbonne, there were kids on the roof with machine guns. All the anti-war demonstrations, the gay pride.
Yep.
There were demonstrations about everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember walking down Bayswater Road, and I look up, and there's Glenda Jackson and John Gielgud, the head of a march, who waved me over.
Uh-huh.
And we're there marching for the Panoffs,
you
know, which were these ballet dancers that were interned in Moscow.
Wow. So that timing was kind of amazing. It's interesting because I guess the arc of the new wave was actually still pretty rebellious, right?
It was very rebellious, but it was coming to an end.
Yeah.
You know, it was coming to an end, and suddenly the popular movies were starting to be like more, you know, middle class kind of dramas.
Right. Well, okay. So it was almost like the middle class won.
They kind of did, and they always do. By the way, you know that. and the Brits are the brilliant at it.
Yes. Yeah.
Any rebel, they will envelop, and embrace, and smother, and have him as their own.
Well, that's what's interesting when I was thinking about, you know, the timing of A Clockwork Orange, because that is the most aggressive satire of fuck you to the entire system. It was almost like it was a final word almost.
Yeah, yeah.
To the apocalyptic vision of what the possibilities are.
That was really special. You know, the sad thing when it came out for me was that they got hung up too much on the violence, so-called.
Yeah.
And I'm like, the violence? The violence is, there's no blood. If you want violence, go see Peckinpah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a ballet of violence.
Right.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Played straight.
Yes.
I mean, like, I think the other thing that people don't realize about A Clockwork Orange, it's a satire.
Satire. Black comedy.
Yeah.
Not one person laughed. When I came over to New York in the first week it opened at Cinema One on Third Avenue, I stood at the back.
Yeah.
Not one laugh.
And how could you not laugh? I mean, the brilliance of, like, Kubrick is that, you know, he had you in a Charlie Chaplin hat on purpose. The whole thing was, you know, that those were clown outfits.
Of course. Yeah, exactly. By the way, you know what they came from? That was my cricket gear.
Oh.
Because one night I was over at his house having a dinner.
Yeah.
And he's walking me back to my car in his driveway.
Yeah.
And he goes, what do you think you'll wear?
Yeah.
And I went, I don't know, Stanley, you know, it's a little futuristic. And he goes, what have you got?
Yeah.
I went, what have I got? I don't have few. I've got jeans and a T-shirt and my cricket gear in the car. He went, go get it. He goes, now, what's this? I went, well, that, you know, that's a protector.
The cup.
He goes, well, wear it on the outside.
Yeah.
And that's how the whole thing, the white. It's the cricket gear.
But just and to tell it, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
So in his
mind,
in his mind, he's just like, this is hilarious.
Yeah.
How could
I know?
And everyone took it so fucking seriously.
And you know, the whole thing of you know, the Singing in the Rain scene, you know, we're sitting around trying to figure out how to do this. And I'm saying, Stanley, look, we've just done we just shot the end. It's this satirical, wonderful transformation of this guy who's in the bed. You know, I was cured, all right.
Yeah.
And
with that knowing look.
Yeah. I say, Stanley, we come in here, we throw bottles through the window. I got to beat up this old guy and then, you know, rape his old lady. I mean, come on. But this is not clever. It's this, we can't do that. Suddenly we're going from the stylized to the naturalistic.
Right.
I mean, it's just, there's no way. So we literally sat around for 4 days.
Yeah.
He changed the furniture. Every time I came in, I'd see the Harrods van. I went, oh, he's changing the furniture again.
Yeah.
And then I was sitting there and he walked past me and he goes, can you dance? And I was so bored by this, I went, can I dance? I'm singing in the rain.
Yeah.
Straight into it, wallop, on the beats. I look over at Stanley. He's literally crying, laughing so hard, and he stuffed his handkerchief in his mouth, and he waves over me, put me in the car, and he drove off, and he bought the rights right there.
No kidding.
And it took a week then to shoot the scene.
And that was all, and that the sort of ironic juxtaposition of that thing, you know, when you tell it, it's hilarious. And it's clearly meant to be comedy, but it's so fucking dark.
Yes. But how incredible that you would have the juxtaposition of this euphoric song that we know. We see Gene on the lamppost, slap, slap, blap, and it's euphoria.
Yeah.
And then you'd see him and he's, you know, beating a guy and raping his.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's no wonder Gene Kelly just, you know.
Did he lose his mind?
Hated it. Yeah. Of course.
Well, I think that satire in general, if it's good, is always completely misunderstood in the broadest sense.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's true.
You know, because I just watched the new one with Nicolas Cage, the Dream Scenario.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a very tight satire.
Yeah.
No one gave a fuck about that movie.
No.
Yeah. And it's like in another one that I don't think gets enough credit is, which did do okay, but I think it needs
which
to be
one?
Tropic Thunder.
Oh, yes, yes. That's, good Lord. Wow.
That's a brilliant fucking satire, but it's a very specific thing to do it correctly and commit to the tone because it's going to be misunderstood.
Well, yes. I mean, the one that I totally love, and I guess it is a satire, sort of, was the movie of Fargo.
Yes.
I have to say, that is my all-time favorite movie.
It's unbelievable. Well,
it's a work of genius.
Totally. I watch it like once a year, twice a year, because the Coens know how to ride this line. Their sense of humor is genius. So specific and
brilliant.
Really fucking amazing.
And, you know, the performance.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's just, one of the great, great cinema performances of all time.
By McDormand?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's unbelievable.
She's an amazing
And it's it is like kind of a comic character.
Yes. Oh, it is totally.
Yeah.
But it walks that fine line.
Yeah.
Which all great characters like that do.
Yeah.
No, it's like Alex in Clockwork.
Yeah.
Or her in that. Or Tony. Doing, you know, his thing.
Tony
Hopkins.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I like to think that he wouldn't be done that if I hadn't have done Alex.
Which one? In Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah.
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 Well, I think Alex changed everything. I mean, yes, people, absolutely. and I imagine, like, when I was watching some of Son of a Critch, the TV show you're in.
Yes.
I thought, like, wouldn't it be a great sketch if they let you reprise Alex as the grandfather?
Oh my God! I'm gonna ask Mark Critch to do that immediately,
just for fun.
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, I just love that show, and I think it's beautifully written, and that's why I really wanted to do it.
It's Critch. Very sweet.
Yes, well, it's sweet, but it's not sentimental. There is sentiment in it,
right?
But it's not sentimental,
right.
And every time it gets too sickly, there's always boom.
Yeah.
They pull the rug under you. And I love that about the writing. I just having so much fun with that.
It's a character. Canadian show originally, right?
It is Canadian.
Well, how did the script get to you?
I believe it came to me from these Irish casting directors who'd seen me do this show in London called Truth Seekers.
Uh-huh.
It was a series that was on Amazon. And she said, well, send it to Malcolm. And Mark said, oh, don't even bother. Let's not. He'll never do this.
What were they basing that on? It's not like you don't like to work.
No, I work a lot. they just didn't think that I would be interested to go to Newfoundland.
Oh, yeah.
And do something which was small. But the truth is, it's all in the writing.
Yeah.
The writing, I read four scripts, called my manager, and I went, make it work. I'm doing it.
Yeah.
I don't care, you know, just work it out.
Well, that's sweet.
Yeah.
He must have been thrilled.
I was just so over the moon. And I go to this place. I had no idea what I was letting myself in for.
Yeah.
And it's a place you should put on your bucket list.
Yeah.
It's another place, a bit like Liverpool.
Yeah.
You don't pass through. You have to go. That's the end of your destination.
Yes.
It's the most amazing place.
It's pretty, right?
It's pretty, but I wouldn't say it's like chocolate box pretty, like, you know, Cornwall or Devon or something.
No, like rugged.
It is rugged. It's like Ireland or Scotland.
Right. Yes.
But it's the people that make the difference.
So one part of Canada I haven't been to.
Well, you should try it.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It's the furthest landmass in North America.
To the east?
To the east.
Yeah.
It's the closest landmass to the Titanic.
Interesting.
And it's right under Greenland.
Yeah.
But I love that, you know, the Newfoundlanders are so proud of their place.
Yeah.
And they'll say, yo, it's Thanksgiving. And they go, you know, it was a Newfoundlander that invented Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
You go, what? That's so weird. I mean, and then Mark will send me a whole thing about, it was. And you know, the Newfoundlanders, they're the ones that built, you know, the skyscrapers in New York. You're going, what? Oh, yeah, they worked on the big schooners and they were used to going up the masts. And they could take the heights.
Oh, they're the ones in those pictures of those guys sitting on girders.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And then
Newfies. Is that slang or is that okay?
Newfies, no, it's not that. They'd say things like, oh, I love Poppy. He goes, well, you know that band, Kiss?
Yeah.
Well, that's a Newfoundland band. And you go, well, no. He goes, that Gene Simmons, he's married to that Shannon Tweed. Now she's from Newfoundland. So that makes it a Newfoundland band by marriage.
You love it.
Yeah, it's great.
But going back to, like, the small community in England, in London, I mean, were all the guys that around, like, you know, like, were Alan Bates and Richard Burton and Courtney and Finney and what was it, Oliver Reed?
Oh, Ollie. I worked with Ollie.
That guy. He's another one that seared his being into my consciousness with Oliver, right? When I was a little kid. And then when I got a little older, it was you as Alex. Yeah.
Oliver Reed, you know, was a really fine actor.
Yeah.
That he doesn't really get the credit for, I don't think. But the problem with Ollie was that he was an alcoholic.
Right.
And he never, ever cleaned up.
Got out from under it?
Never did.
Well, it seems like a lot of them were.
Well, it was a thing. The generation before me were all piss artists.
Yeah.
They'd all...
Richard Harris.
Oh, yeah. Harris, Burton, all those guys.
Peter O'Toole.
You know, they'd be straight into the pub, and it was a manly thing. You'd stay up all night drinking and then end up at the set at 9 o'clock the next morning and do your scene.
How the fuck did they do that?
How did they? I have no idea. But I heard that they'd sworn off when they did Beckett. It was... Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole. And they said, right, at the beginning, we're swearing off booze. We're going to do the whole film without a drink.
Yeah.
Which they did until the last day. the penultimate day, they went on the piss.
Yeah.
And they just went crazy.
Yeah.
All nighter. Ended up, all O'Toole had to do was walk down the nave of Canterbury Cathedral in his armor, whatever it was.
Yeah.
He literally walks down there, kneels, and just topples over, and they couldn't even wake him. they had to cancel for the day.
what you hear about these guys, and then at the peak of it all is this other character in Laurence Olivier. He never gets included in any of the riffraff stories, but he hovers above all of it.
Well, you know, he was sort of untouchable. You know, he was Sir. I got a call from my agent.
Oh, yeah.
And the agent said, Sir wants to see you.
Yeah.
And I knew immediately who Sir was.
Yeah.
And I went, what about? It's a pin to play. He wants you to do it. I went, oh, my God, this is great.
Yeah.
Yes. I went to meet him.
Yeah.
And he said, we play lovers, you know. We're very much in the closet, but I think we'll have fun, and I want you to do it. I went, yes, sir, absolutely. And so it's me, Albert. Alan Bates, who I adored. I worked with him 3 times. And Helen Mirren.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And... Olivier, I tell this story. It's funny.
Yeah.
So and the whole thing is that, you know, I'm his lover.
Yeah.
I'm like a rent boy.
Yeah.
And he's a posh, right? The Eaton Square house. Yeah. All the rest. And Alan Bates comes around threatening, accusing me of having an affair with his wife, Helen Mirren. So, and obviously this guy I play, you know, he doesn't care what it is, as long as it's, you know, he's just an opportunist.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, but it's deeply, has to be in the closet. Otherwise, it ruins the play.
Yeah.
The first read-through, 60 people there, all waiting. Olivier plays it like he's swinging a handbag in high heels. And Alan Bates and I were like, sort of giggling, I mean, hiding. I'm thinking, wow, we have got no play here. If he does it like that, you know, it's incredible. So, and it was made for television. So we kept saying to the director, a young Michael Apted, who went on to do, you know, he's a really good
big director.
A Coal Miner's Daughter.
Yes.
We kept saying, Michael, have you told Sir yet? And he'd go, no, tomorrow. I'll tell him tomorrow. He was terrified. So at the end of the week, we're watching him, and he's whispering in Olivier's ear. And he goes, of course, dear boy. I always play it big, and then bring it in. And we're like, oh, thank God. And, of course, Alan Bates, who is a generation above me, was saying, you know, he's so brave, Malcolm. Olivier is the bravest. I went, oh, come off it. He's an old ham.
Yeah.
You know it, and I know it. Come on. He goes, no, he is so brave. That is brilliant what he did. We should do that. I went, what? Go on and do it gay? I went, are you out of your mind? What are you talking about? Because it's so brave. We should push ourselves, push our performance and go into a... I went, oh, come on, Alan.
Yeah.
So we went out there. He has the bank, knock on the door. I open it and say, yes. I open it. I went, yes.
Yeah.
We burst out laughing. That was the end of that experiment. Oh, but Alan Bates, what a fabulous, fabulous actor.
And did Olivier bring it in?
Oh, he was brilliant. Yeah, he did. But get this. So we were rehearsing in the Oval.
Yeah.
And for lunch, we'd go to this little pub and sit in the little snug bar. And we're sitting there. And it's freezing out, you know, and we're sitting there. We've ordered a pork pie and half a bitter, right? And we're sitting there. And so a lorry driver comes in, opens the door, comes in, and he orders his lager, whatever. He turns around and he goes, "Oh, come on, fucking hell. It's the old Clockwork Banana, isn't it?" And I went, "Oh, God." He goes, "Oh, come on, no. You got to sign this. Sign it. Come on. Here, use that beer mat. Have you got a pen?"
Yeah,
sign it. And I went, "Oh, there you go." And then he looks, he sees Alan, and he goes, "Oh, it's Tom Jones." I didn't want to, tell him that it's Albert Finney. But Alan goes, rather irritated, signs it. And then he's doing it. I look at Olivia, and I see this sort of look. You know, I said, "Well, excuse me, but surely you want the autograph of the greatest ever living actor." And he goes, "Well, yeah, who's that?" And I went, "This is Sir Laurence Olivier."
Yeah.
And he looked and he went, "Nah." Got up and left. Alan whispered in my ear, "We'll pay for that this afternoon." I went, "You will. I don't have any scenes with him."
Oh, my God. What about Michael Caine? Do you know Michael Caine?
I do. We had the same agent for a long time. He's he's phenomenal, really, isn't he?
But not a huge stage actor, right?
No, I mean, he did movies. He's a movie actor. He's a movie star. You know,
it's unbelievable, that guy.
He really is. He's amazing. Tip my hat to him.
And he retired, I guess.
I think they brought him out, wheeled him out for one more.
Oh, yeah?
I don't think you ever retire.
Yeah.
If they suddenly dangle a really good part.
Yeah.
Hey.
You're going to do it?
You're going to do it.
Now, this is just a personal thing, because I've done a bit of acting, and it's very, what do you do with all that fucking time on your hands, like in the trailer?
I'm bored for one second.
No.
I mean, not for one second.
What do you
second.
Read? Or do you
I
just
read,
think?
No, I mean, I love to gossip and chat and have fun.
Yeah.
You know, to go pull a few legs, you know, of actors who have taken it too seriously.
Yeah.
And I just think, I'm still getting paid for this. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to wake up and go and pull the rug.
Yeah.
But I just love what I do.
Yeah.
It's so much fun. I try to take my kids who want to be actors. I say, it's just so much fun pretending to be somebody else.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
They want to be actors?
Yeah.
How many you got?
Well, I've got two that want to be actors.
Yeah.
And they're 15 and 17 now.
Yeah. Was that
Finn
with
and Seamus?
With Mary?
No, this is my present wife that I've been with for 34 years.
Oh, yeah.
Kelly. With Mary, I have Charlie, who's this wonderful director, and Lily, who's the only daughter and my oldest child.
Yeah.
And she's got three daughters, so I have three granddaughters.
Wow.
Who are great.
I had Mary on here, and we had a great chat, and she spoke very highly of you.
I love her to death, and she was so sweet. I did a little Western with James Paxton, Bill's son.
Yeah.
In fact, I was going to do it with Bill.
Yeah.
And, so when they got it together again, I said, "Well, let's get James to do it."
Yeah.
Bill would be so thrilled. And I asked Mary to come and play a really important part right at the very end.
Yeah.
And she did. And I wondered how the hell that would be, because we hadn't worked together since we did Holiday at the Old Vic, directed by Lindsay Anderson on stage.
Oh, wow.
And it was sort of a long time ago, I think 87 or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was literally like putting on an old pair of slippers.
Wow.
It felt so comfortable working together. I know we both really loved it.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah, because if you can do that, if you can maintain the friendship and the love with an ex, it's good for everybody.
Well, it's been up and down. I wouldn't say that's,
Yeah.
And it's been a long time, but, we have these two stunning children.
Yeah. And you get along with Ted Danson?
Yeah, I love Ted.
Yeah. Nice guy.
Yeah, he's a very nice guy. I think I once said to Mary, we have T-shirts at our house that says, "I love Ted." And she went, well, why would you do that? I went, because we love Ted. And we do.
Yeah.
He's the greatest guy,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
His kids are great, too.
Yeah. Well, that's nice that you get along with everybody.
Yeah, well, it's a big extended deal.
Yeah, yeah. You know. And you live here?
Yes. So I've lived here longer than I lived in England.
Do you miss England?
No.
Yeah, it's funny. I talked to Bernie Taupin, and he doesn't give a fuck. He's been here since the 70s. Looking back.
That's when I came, late 70s. I agree. I mean, when I go there, I love it.
Yeah.
I love going to London. It's such a great city.
Yeah.
And I love working there. I'm doing a vampire movie at the moment.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of it. And I just have so much fun, you know, when I go back there. But can I live there? Jesus, no.
Yeah.
No,
why?
No. Well, the weather sucks,
okay,
for one
thing.
Okay,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you realize, you know, it's a small little island.
Yes, yes.
It's very provincial in many ways.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love a lot of it.
Yeah.
It has great actors, great theater.
Yeah.
I mean, I always love working with British actors.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know you're going to get 100%.
And you worked with O'Toole on Caligula, right?
Yes, yes.
Was he Tiberius? Is that who
he
played?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So you got to work with him. Was that the only time?
I got to work with him the only time. The only other time I met him was that I was playing small parts at the Royal Shakespeare Company. And there was a party. This is 1964.
Yeah.
Or five.
Yeah.
And there was a party, bring a bottle, you know, up in Hampstead.
Yeah.
And we were all, you know, the young actors, all that from the Royal Shakespeare Company. And suddenly there was a hush in this apartment.
Yeah.
And I looked over, and there was this Greek god.
Yeah.
And it was Peter O'Toole with the flaxen hair, cigarette holder.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
This big smile.
Yeah.
As thin as a rail, you know, with the big boots up to his knees, jeans tucked in, looking like this incredible movie star.
Yeah.
Mr. Charisma.
Yeah.
There he was, Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
And when I worked with him, I had a lot of fun with him.
Well, that was like, if I remember right, at that point, Tiberius was rotting away, right?
Yes, he got syphilis. He was dying.
Yeah, yeah. Now that, like, I have not watched it recently, but when I watched years ago in Caligula, I must have been in high school when it came out, but there's, you know, that, the integration of porn into that movie.
Yeah, well, listen.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned it because there's an amazing story that goes with this.
As a young person, the blowjob in the middle of that movie, it changed my life.
Yeah, well, for you or on screen?
Well, I mean, everything.
Yeah.
Because you don't see it coming, and then it definitely comes.
So get this, you know, of course, Guccione's version of the movie was sort of put together in a shambolic way, then inserted like 40 minutes of pornography.
Yeah.
And, you know, with our names. About
you didn't know about it.
No. And we couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
You're contracted to make, Gore Vidal pulled his name off.
Yeah.
And I went, thanks, Gore. I can't pull my face off.
Yeah.
You know, so we were screwed.
Yeah. And that was like the peak of your thing, right? Yeah. Had you just moved here?
I wasn't living in,
not yet.
It was before I did Time After Time.
Yeah.
I did Time After Time as a kind of catharsis moment to get away from Caligula, actually.
Yeah.
Recently, three or four years ago, this guy is looking on the internet, this nerd guy in Czechoslovakia, and he looks and he wants to kind of buy a thing on the internet, and he looks and he finds Penthouse.
Yeah, pictures, sure.
Fire sale, buys it. And they go, what do you want to do with all these cases, the boxes that are in this, storage in the valley?
Yeah.
Send somebody down. He goes, oh, that's all the negative from Caligula.
Yeah.
This guy, Tom Ngoven, transferred it all onto digital.
Yeah.
They recut the movie as the movie we made.
Oh, really?
It's phenomenal. I mean, it is the movie we made. And I'm going, I wasn't going crazy.
Right.
It's like amazing. For instance, Helen Mirren's performance in the Guccione version is 17 minutes.
Yeah.
In this version, an hour.
Yeah.
So the whole last 45 minutes has never been seen.
Yeah.
He just dumped it.
Yeah.
Didn't even bother.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't bother to.
So it does work as a movie.
It works absolutely, and it's amazing. And it's going to be out in August.
Really?
Yeah.
That's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And it's going to open at the British Film Institute. And I'm going to go over and...
And who's recutting it?
This guy, Tom.
He did it. Yeah.
He's absolutely did an amazing job. I mean, he deserves all the plaudits.
Did he find the script? Is that how it worked?
He looked at the script. But, you know, Gore Vidal's script is crap, I'll be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, I had to bring in a playwright from London to help me. You know, I was really, I mean, because I was in every frame of it, I had to really try and make sure I survived it.
Yeah.
You know, that was my, you know, big thing, is just trying to get through it without, you know, stumbling too badly.
Right.
So I brought over this writer called Ted Whitehead,
who had
written this play called Alpha Beta with Albert Finney and Rachel Roberts. And he came over, spent a month with me, and we'd work at night.
Yeah.
And
then Guccione would let you make the changes?
Oh, Guccione, yeah, because he'd fallen out with Gore. And Gore had taken his name off it by this time.
Yeah.
But we had this director who was, you know, very, he was way left of communists, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Really an anarchist, actually. He was like, and the first thing he said to me, if we do not screw Penthouse, we fail. I went, Tinto, let's just try and make a good movie, you know.
Yeah.
Let's not worry about who the producers are.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Gore Vidal told me, when I asked him, who's paying for this? You know, is it studio movie? No, can't be, can it? And he said, it's Bob Guccione. And I went, oh, the pornographer? He said, Malcolm, just think of him as one of the Warner Brothers.
Yeah. Everyone was getting the money.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fucking great story. Well, now I'm excited to, I'm going to be sad that the, you know, the big blowjob's not in there. But
you can still see that. You know, get the other disc, but to see it as the director intended it, it's really fantastic.
Well, now that I know that about the director, I'm like, I can look at it.
Well, the sad thing is, Tinto Brass, who I had enormous respect for, he's sadly got dementia, and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't really know.
Yeah.
He won't be able to know anything about it.
Right.
But I know, because I knew him intimately well, and I really liked him a lot, and we did it together.
Yeah.
I know that he would really respect this cut.
Well, that's good.
And Thomas did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
Changed the music, this kind of animation at the beginning, gives you kind of little history thing going on. Oh, good. And so you kind of get the context of it.
Yeah.
And it's really...
The context of the film or the,
no, where
of
you're,
the story
where,
of Caligula?
Where Caligula is.
Oh, okay.
The, where his father was this great general, was this great, you know, hero, a Roman hero.
Yeah.
And Caligula, as a child, went on with the armies, and he was called Little Boots.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really a fascinating
story. Oh, that's interesting.
And, you know, it's really amazingly true.
Yeah.
That all those sets in Caligula, all the stuff that's going on, the feasts and this and that.
I remember it being very, almost like a play.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of the sets.
It's sort of big. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's... And they were massive sets.
Oh, they were, yeah.
And, you know, it's Danilo Donati designed it. It was Fellini's designer.
Yeah.
An absolute genius.
Yeah. Wow. And what was your relationship with Bob Altman?
Oh, I love that man. Yeah. I don't know an actor that doesn't love Bob.
Yeah, no.
I knew Bob in 1970. We smoked a lot of weed together.
Yeah.
We partied.
We're in Britain?
No, you come over to London, I'd get a call, he'd go, Bob's in town.
Yeah.
I went, you mean you're in town? Yeah, Bob. Yeah. How, what you doing, kid?
Yeah.
What are you doing tonight? We're going to this restaurant. Why don't you come by? And I'd go by, and it was always, I'd come out of his place, wherever he was, and it would always be dawn was breaking.
Yeah.
And I, oh, my God, I got to stop this.
Yeah.
But we had so much fun. And wherever he was, when he was in Rome, I was in Rome.
Yeah.
I introduced him to Guccione at some party I had at my villa.
Yeah.
And Bob came in. He went over. He goes, I said, Guccione wants to meet you. So he walked over to him and he goes, Hey, Mr. Gucci, I like your shoes.
Yeah.
I went, no, it's Guccione, it's not Gucci. Bob immediately put him on the defensive.
No, I just did a screening. I presented a screening of McCabe and Mrs. Miller last month.
Was it a good print?
It was okay. My buddy had an original print, from the 70s.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty good print, and there were some things about it that film nerds know that I didn't know about the color. But you know, it's such an amazing movie.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah,
well, it's a great movie.
Oh my God, it's one of the best. I mean, I watch it quite often
with Julie and Warren. Yeah.
Do you know Julie?
I know her. I know briefly. I don't know her that well.
I just watched Shampoo again. That was something.
She's incredible.
Yeah. And Hal Ashby, do you know that guy?
Oh, brilliant. I loved him.
Yeah.
I met him.
Yeah. Peter Sellers?
I knew him well because, as he liked to say, you know, Malcolm, we're in a special little thing together, you and I, because we starred in Stanley Kubrick movies.
Yeah.
He was always, that was to him his favorite movies.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
Strangelove,
his performance.
Oh yeah,
his
three performances.
Oh, I think more, isn't it?
Played Mandrake. He played the president.
Yeah.
What else? And Strangelove. So it was three left. Yeah,
that performance. I mean, you know that all that stuff was ad-libbed. I mean, he improv that the Nazi salute. Genius. Scott, I mean, was fantastic.
George C. Scott? Unbelievable. He's unbelievable.
But he hated Stanley. I had dinner with him.
With George?
Yeah. He was doing a play, and I was.
Yeah.
I got a note saying, hey, it's George C. Scott here. Do you want to have dinner tonight?
Yeah.
I went, yes, please.
Yeah.
I love you.
Yeah.
And he just bitched about Stanley the whole time. So he couldn't stand him.
Well, I think I heard a story about that I think what the issue was is that I don't think George C. Scott knew it was a comedy necessarily.
Yeah. Well, probably Stanley didn't know, you know.
Right. And that, you know, the character, you know, became this great comedic character.
If you hire Peter Sellers.
Yeah. It's going to be a comedy.
You know that somewhere down the line it's going to be funny.
Yeah.
And Peter had such a take, you know, I remember laughing with Stanley and saying, I know why you love Peter Sellers.
Yeah.
I said, because you just ask him to do, you know, funny voices. He'd give you 40 characters.
Yeah.
And you'd just pick one. Yeah. And he sort of went, it kind of was like that.
Well, that was the amazing thing about being there, the Hal Ashby film.
Oh, that's incredible.
It's so muted, but so brilliant.
Heartfelt. It's stunning. It's a stunning performance.
It's unbelievable.
It's his... I mean, he had to do all the other stuff to get to that.
Yeah, because he actually was able to inhabit the character to the point where he had this weird kind of shallowness to his eyes.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he was in it.
Yes, absolutely.
And it enabled everyone to project what they believed.
Yeah.
It's
one of the great performances.
And was he, as a person, did he land in a personness? Like, did you know?
Oh, no. He was, he was hot and cold. I mean, every time they'd want to go to dinner, I'd get the call. Peter wants you to come. I went, okay. Okay. And we drive out of London to some, you know, three-star restaurant.
Yeah.
But Peter then would sit there at the table with his head on the tablecloth out of it.
Yeah.
He had
up and down, bipolary kind of.
He was totally bipolar.
Yeah.
And he would be out of it.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a really incredible story that happened, because this agent we had, we all had him in common, Dennis Selinger at ICM in London. He had Michael... You know, Sean Connery, all of them.
Yeah.
Peter, myself. It was his sister's birthday. And so we all met at a private room in Julie's restaurant in Penzance Place. We all get there. There's like 20 of us, right? And in this huge long table. And Dennis pulls me aside. I've put Peter next to you because you know that he's, you know, I went, don't worry about it. It's fine. I'll look after him. Don't worry. So, you know, he put his head down and boom, he was out.
Yeah.
So we're all chatting away. I'm chatting to the guy next to me. He was a producer or something. I don't know. And we're talking and laughing. We're halfway through the thing. And suddenly one of the girls, one of the wives, I mean, jumps up on the other side of the table and goes, oh, my God, my diamond stud has come out of my... Oh, I've lost my diamond stud. And everyone's going, what? Oh, my God, looking on the floor. Suddenly, Sellers sits up, comes to, does 20 minutes stand-up,
as Clouseau, yeah, accusing everyone of stealing the diamond. It was absolute. I looked over at Michael Caine. I've never seen him laugh. He was crying. He almost couldn't take a breath. It was genius. And I suddenly went, this is what it must have been like, you know, to see Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
And then did he go right back down? Did he put his head back on the table?
Well, I'd brought this girl with me.
Yeah.
She wasn't my girlfriend. She was a girl that I was working with. And I and Peter had said to me, he goes, you know, Malcolm, I can walk into a room of 40 women and I can go up, and they are all, you know, I can go up to one of them who is poison for me, and I'll walk straight up to her and I'll ask her to marry me.
Yeah.
I went, get out of here.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Peter, come on.
Yeah.
You know? So there I was with Lynn, who I was working with on in this movie, and I brought, and Peter goes, oh, are you with her? I went, no, she's just a friend. We're working together.
Yeah.
Just brought her because she wanted to, you know, meet all the A-listers.
Yeah.
And he went, oh, we'll come back to the apartment. I went, yeah. Next thing is they're married.
Yeah. How'd that go?
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Cut. 2 years go by. I'm walking into my maison, you know, the one on Melrose, when it was there. I walk into Melrose. There's Lynn.
Yeah.
She jumps up, waves, and hey, darling, big hugs. She goes, oh, yes, I'm having lunch with my lawyer. I went, oh, yeah, really? She goes, don't say anything, but I'm leaving, Peter.
Yeah.
I can't take it. I went, oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
That weekend, he died.
Oh, my God.
He died. And there's pictures of her in the widow's weeds,
you know,
getting off the plane in London.
Yeah.
It's like, if it had been another week.
Yeah. And you knew.
I know.
You knew that.
Yeah.
So now when you worked, like, you obviously took this son of a critch as because you loved it.
Yes.
But what drives you to choose things? Like, because you did the Bombshell, and that was great.
Yeah, no, it's good. I love doing that. That was fantastic. You know, I did a movie with Jane Fonda, Moving On.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Paul Weiss.
Yeah.
And Lily Tomlin.
Oh, yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
absolutely
brilliant.
I've got a couple of movies come out, and I did a movie with June Squibb, 92 years old, when she played the lead in this movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, what an inspiration she was.
Yeah.
And she's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's called Thelma. It's a great little movie.
Yeah.
That's coming out. I got a Western. It's called Last Train to Fortune.
Okay.
But I love going to Newfoundland. I can't wait to get back for the summer. I just think it's the greatest show.
You're going
to
shoot a new season?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the idea.
And there's three up now?
There's three seasons. We hope to go into a fourth. We haven't heard officially, but we feel that we will.
So it was a Canadian show, and now...
It's CBC. It's the biggest comedy show they've got in Canada.
And now the CW here has picked it up.
They picked it up with Lionsgate.
Yeah.
That's another partner.
Yeah.
And the CW, you know, they're retooled and kind of doing some cool stuff.
Here. So... So they came in as production partners.
Yeah.
And then you're shooting a new season.
Yes. Well, we hope to.
Yeah.
I think we've been told officially.
But okay.
Everyone thinks we're going to. But,
okay.
Never take it anything for granted.
Yeah. Well, it was great talking to you.
You too.
Thanks for doing it.
Was that an hour?
Hour plus. Hour 10.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
When you're having fun.
Yeah, it was great. I loved it. Thanks for doing it.
You're great.
Right? Wow. What a great guy. Son of a Critch is on the CW app or at CWTV.com. New episodes are out. And hang out for a minute.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
People, we have another episode of WTF Origins coming up on the Full Marin this week. If you want to catch up, you can listen to the most recent Origins episode about my stint on LA radio with the Marc Maron show. There was one show that, you know, I accidentally dropped a fuck, which is not a big deal because we're pre-recording it.
Yeah.
But then Jim dropped a fuck.
Yeah.
To counter my fuck. And then we just started dropping a lot of fucks and a lot of shits. And just like, we just started doing it like crazy. Yeah. Just getting laughs from Laughing Andy. And, you know, we finished the show. And I'm like, you're gonna take those out, right? You're going to beep them. He's like, yeah. So we leave. And then I got to go to Vegas. All I know is I'm in Vegas. And I'm doing a show at the Palms. And Misha's with me. And we're trying to have a nice time. And I don't remember that comic's name who texted me.
I do. I know who it was. It was Spencer Dobson.
Spencer Dobson. Right.
And so he texted you that he was so proud to work on a show that had the balls to do what you just did.
Right. And I'm like, what happened? And what happened was...
the fuck version, not the bleeped version.
And all I'm thinking is like, I'm finished. I mean, you know... this is it. This is the bit. And I'm like, a show has just aired in Los Angeles for 2 hours. That's just a fuck fest. Now, I know.
It's not a good kind of fuck fest.
No. To subscribe to The Full Marin, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Got a new little amp. It was a gift. And I have a couple of guitars and two amps that are just the best things in the world. Here's one of them. Two of them, actually. The guitar and amp. Okay. Monkey and La Fonda, cat angels everywhere.